Today I wanted to finish up the sessions I've been giving by looking a little bit at the problems of working with convicts. Some of you may take seriously the admonitions to work with the oppressed or to work with those in prison or the sick or whatever. And so I wanted to enlighten you as to some of the problems that you might run into in doing this, and also talk about some of the strengths that you yourself need in working with people who are on the other side, people who have a different worldview and experiences that support a different worldview, that come from a different environment than you probably have come from. I wanted to start by reading a story, the story of Jonah. And this is by Ann Herbert. The other night, I think it was Sunday night, when Dan Erlander gave Vespers, he read the story of Adam and Eve and the fall, which was taken from a book by Ann Herbert. And she does a pretty good job at this, taking these biblical stories and putting them in some kind of up-to-date way so that we understand the kind of, maybe better understand the kind of pressures and situations that were influencing the people that were involved. I'll just go ahead and read this. And the point of, let me tell you before I start, the point of this is to show us the dangers of looking at life or looking at dividing up people in a dualistic way as sort of them and us. And we tend to do this. We tend to look at, you know, the oppressed and the oppressors. She gives several examples of this. So we can divide the world up into straights and gays, men and women, men versus women, whites versus blacks, ruling class versus the masses, peaceful people versus violent people, what she calls the pets' view of the world, humans versus animals, the conservatives' view of the world, liberals and patriots. But we always tend to look at ourselves as in the minority or as the ones that are being oppressed and in this larger group that is evil. I'd like to tell you about Jonah, the guy who lives in the Bible about halfway between Elijah and Luke. A lot of you probably think Jonah is the story of a man and his whale. That's not exactly true. Jonah is the story about the joy of hatred. Jonah is the story about that exhilarating feeling you get when you discover someone who is really morally more reprehensible than you are. Jonah discovered that joy, and Jonah's basic thing was hating Ninevites. Ninevites lived far away from him, and he'd never met any of them, but he had a lot of data about them. Now, hating Ninevites was not like hating Jews, Catholics, black people, etc. Hating Ninevites was like hating American Nazis, builders of nuclear reactors, and tuna fishermen. It was a rational, well-researched hatred based on the actual behavior of the Haitis. Jonah had a lot of data on Ninevites, and he was building a career on them. He had just had a story about the relationship of Ninevites, the Mobil Oil Corporation, and saccharin on the cover of Mother Jones. He was hitting the junior college circuit with a speech about Ninevites, and he was hoping to make the Ivy League soon. So he was not surprised when one day God came to him to talk to him about the Ninevites. He had never spoken to God before, and he really wasn't a God groupie, but he figured God knew who the expert was, right? So God came to Jonah and said, "Jonah, I'm going to destroy the Ninevites." And Jonah said, "Wow, you must have read my article." And God said, "Before I destroy them, I want to warn them. It only seems fair. Since you know so much about them, I want you to go to Nineveh and tell them I'm going to destroy them so they'll have a chance to change their ways and save themselves." And Jonah said, "No way in hell. I don't want to go there. They're creepy people. And besides that, what if they change?" So Jonah took off. He took the Greyhound bus to the most distant point available, only it wasn't a Greyhound bus at that point in time, it was a boat. He got on the boat and he thought he would skip town and all would be cool. He did not know he was dealing with a whole earth god. God followed him in the boat and started a very large sea storm. The captain of the boat was extremely upset about the sea storm. He was an experienced captain who knew a theological sea storm when he saw it. So he said, "Someone on this boat is not on speaking terms with God. Let's draw lots and see who." Jonah said, "We don't need to do that. I'm the one. I'll jump overboard because it seems like the only way I'm going to win." Now, it turned out that God knew, as well as any civil rights legislator knows, that the only way to overcome hatred is with brute force. And God doesn't give up easily. So when Jonah jumped over the side of the boat, God had a whale there to catch him. Jonah landed in the whale, stayed in the whale with the rotting fish and the whale digestive juices for 3 days. Jonah was a stubborn man of principle. It took 72 hours of an unusual smell for him to change his mind. But finally he said, "Oh, heck, God, I'll go to Nineveh." So the whale barfed him up on the shore near Nineveh, and he was headed for the world capital of badness. Now, when he got to Nineveh, he was pleased to see that everything that he had ever thought about Nineveh was true. I mean, they were right there on the streets using sweatshop labor to run a nuclear reactor that powered an ITT plant that made neutron bombs, whale trawlers, and saccharin. He was naturally appalled, so he got into his street beggar mode, which he had once used to support his Ninevite research, and he started things in a way... He started things in a way that not very many people would hear him. He shuffled down the street, leaned against the walls, and muttered, "Repent, repent. In 40 days you will be destroyed if you don't repent." You had to be walking right by him to hear him. But the first person who happened to walk by him happened to be bored with his job as a nuclear reactor janitor. And he said, "Wow, you're right. This is really awful. Let's all repent." And that guy started yelling Jonah's message, and it turned out that a lot of people were bored with their jobs as neutron bombardiers and saccharin cane cutters, and they went to the president of the country and said, "We've been gross and awful, and we're going to repent, and you have to, too." They put on sackcloth and ashes, they turned their nuclear reactor into a solar generator, and they all planted organic gardens, and Jonah was ticked off. He was just furious, and he said, "Okay, God, are you going to be conned by these hypocrites? Do you think that just because they're behaving different, they're better?" And God said, "Afraid so. Behavior counts. You lose." So Jonah stomped up to a hill outside of town and sat under a tree praying for the Ninevites to show their true nature and for God to fry them alive. And all that happened was that God destroyed the tree Jonah was sitting under, so he got a sunburn. Jonah said, "God, how come you destroyed this tree? This tree never did nothing." He did a 10-minute rap about the tree and how trees are important. You can't just destroy them for no reason. And God said, "How come, Jonah, how come? Wherefore, why is it that you care so much about that tree when you have no pity at all for Nineveh, a city that has a whole lot of folks in it, and some children and animals, and you wanted me to kill them all? How come you didn't care about them?" And that's the end of the book in the Bible. You're left there with the question. You never know what Jonah said. And you can find out, the question is for you, what are you going to do? Can you live without hatred? And then she adds a little... saying at the end here about Gandhi. She says, Gandhi said, which is kind of what I paraphrase up there, Gandhi said that the ally you must always seek is the part of your enemy that knows what is right. So I wanted to use this as an introduction for dealing with people that we consider to be enemies and as a way of cutting into this dualistic kind of thinking so that we don't consider... So that we can start looking at people as, you know, in terms of difference or different degrees and start seeing that maybe our enemies, we have some points at which we can identify with them and break through and work with them. Now, I want to... Right, yeah. And when I read this, this week I went back and read the book of Jonah again, and I the only part is the beginning part. We have to say, why did God come to Jonah this way, you know? And she fills that in, you know, in terms of his research and his lecture circuit. I wanted to talk about prison personalities to start with, because I wanted to show how this personality develops among convicts and the point of view they have about life and the world, their experiences that have led up to that, and to show, in a sense, the difficulty of breaking through that, and maybe some of the few ways or only possible ways of doing that. In his book, The Belly of the Beast, which maybe some of you have heard about, Jack Abbott, who was in prison for life and just... considered to be quite an evil person. A couple years ago, time passes so quickly, he hit the newspapers because Norman Mailer took up his case. He had sent the manuscript of his book to Norman Mailer, and Mailer thought, well, he was a great budding author, and so he ought to be out on parole. So Mailer worked for his parole, and he came to New York and got some apartment down on the Lower East Side and in New York, which is the ghetto slum section of New York. And one of the first things he did when he was there for about a week or two was to kill somebody, and then he went back into prison again. But in his book, he makes a couple points that are interesting about prison. He said Abbott had come up through the system. In other words, had gone through the juvenile delinquency institutions and then graduated into prison. And he said one of the things is that about prison is that one is expected, or there's the expectation, that prisoners are supposed to act like children. In other words, that adults are supposed to act like children. In other words, be passively dependent. So that a good adjustment to prison is this passive dependence, where one just takes orders and points of view about oneself that the authorities have, that one is not an independent, autonomous actor. Then he pointed out in delinquency institutions, it's exactly the opposite. You're always told, why don't you grow up? You know, why don't you act older? Why are you acting like a kid? And so you have this contradiction in terms where one is being persecuted in these institutions when they're a child because they're not mature, not adult enough to handle it. And on the other hand, as adults, they're expected to give up their independence or autonomy as adulthood, as an adult. And I was pointing out this the other day, that that's one of the things that prison really teaches, is how to be passively dependent, irresponsible for oneself. And to take up responsibility again after release is very difficult, even for people from the middle class or upper middle class who have had a lot of experience with that in the past. But what I want to talk about today is people that haven't come from the middle class or upper middle class, people that have gone through this school of crime that starts out at a very early age. The prison and adjustment to prison is a lot like, it's a resocialization process, a lot like going into the military or going to a strict boarding school, things like that, where a person is supposed to leave off, give up their identity, their civilian identity, who they were, what they were, what they liked, and all those kinds of things, and take on a new identity. And the process of resocialization is similar to, in some respects, to, for example, going into the military. You know, if you have long hair and that's part of your identity, you lose that quickly. If, you know, the idea of wearing a uniform, so that there's, you can't make those status differentiations that one might make on the outside in terms of who's who. One loses their name, acquires a number, so that you have to learn that number, and all your mail is addressed to that number, and when you're referred to within the prison, you're referred to in terms of that number. Of course, one loses a job, that kind of identity from work. One uses the ability to be sexual toward the opposite sex, and that source of identity is taken away, to play family roles, the autonomy of self, to make decisions about oneself and to produce an end. In other words, to take a path toward an end and be an autonomous acting individual. That's taken away from one. In fact, that is considered to be a threat to the system, the more autonomous that a person is. In other words, they're not taking up this prisoner, this convict identity. Decisions, responsibilities that are taken away from one. I mentioned uniforms. The deference that's required, it's a caste system. The prisoners are supposed to be on one level, the authorities or staff on another level. Sometimes some prisons shave heads, you know, these types of things. There's one of the, probably for us, if we thought about going to prison, one of the most serious sources of this mortification of self that we would go through is this contamination, that we're forced to associate daily, 24 hours a day, with people that we've never thought we'd be around in our whole life, and that make us sick to our stomach to be around. How does one handle that? What does that mean in terms of oneself? And so, to the extent that a person, you know, you can think of in the military, there's this demand that a person show deference. You know, you learn to say sir, all those types of things. And this goes on in prison too. If one doesn't show the deference, then there's methods that are used, like solitary confinement or brutality by guards or whatever, that bring this about. One of these is a process called looping, where a person deliberately antagonizes. Maybe you see boys that get in a fight, and one boy wants to fight and the other boy doesn't want to fight. And so the way to make the boy that wants to fight has to push the other kid to the point of wanting to fight. Well, you see, if a guard does this to an inmate, in other words, pushes the inmate until the inmate reacts, then that reaction, that assertion of self and self-respect is used as evidence for further punishment. Now, you know, okay, the reaction, now even further punishment. Well, prisoners come to prison with presenting personalities, the way people come to most institutions, so that you don't find one reaction or one adjustment to prison. You find several. And it, of course, depends on the environment, the situation, the experiences the person's had in their past life. One of these is rebellion. And this is the one that Jack Henry Abbott focused upon and maintained his whole identity and status from in prison. And this is the kind of thing like, how many days in solitary confinement can you do? What's the record? You know, I've talked to convicts, and you know, they say, my brother holds the record at San Quentin for solitary confinement, you know, or something like this. You know, or how much brutality can you undergo and still maintain this rebellious attitude and still not conform to the rules and show no deference to authority and continually attempt to counteract and put down authority. It's the toughest, and so it's probably the one that's least used. And those people who do use it end up, you hear these horrible stories. It's a self-reinforcing system, so that the more a person rebels, the harder the authorities come down on them, which produces a greater rebellion for some of these people. They eventually end up with things like suicide or homicide or just a consistent sense of rage. Then there's situational withdrawal, sometimes called stupefaction or prison psychosis. And this is a withdrawal, exactly what it says, a situational withdrawal. In its extreme forms, a person goes to bed and doesn't get up again and doesn't come out of their cell. But it's sort of putting one's mind on or brain on hold and being not reactive, unemotional. I think almost all prisoners undergo this to some extent. And when you meet somebody that's just come out of prison, they have their emotions are almost flat. You know, they have almost no reaction. They can't get excited about anything. They're in a stupor. And this is a defense mechanism that their body has undertaken while they've been in prison. Another approach or another adjustment is called conversion. And this is where the individual, like a colonized person, becomes totally identifies with the prison. And this is the kind of situation where the person can't conceive of leaving prison. Sometimes you see this in mental hospitals too. You know, like you open the door, they don't want to walk out. This happened in the liberation of prison camps after World War II, that the Allies would come in and liberate the camp. But the prisoner's identity was so tied up in the camp, and this happened with concentration camps too, that they couldn't conceive of themselves not being in that camp any longer. You know, now, I have no other life than this. And so you find people that forestall their parole and methods of not leaving prison. Then the last one is called the model prisoner. And this is the kind of adjustment that prison officials hope to achieve. This is probably one, especially with situations like in delinquency institutions where you have indeterminate sentences. This is the kind of adjustments that's necessary to get out. And this means to give up one's own autonomy, ideas about oneself, and take on the staff's view of oneself. And to be able to voice that and the words and to give a conception of oneself vocally that the authorities have of oneself. I don't know if I'm getting across with that, but it's like, you know, if you go to a counselor or a psychiatrist or something like that, a person ends up in prison, it's a low status. And so one tries to avoid the sense of blame. You know, like, what happened in my life that I ended up here? It's not my fault. You know, everybody's out there is crooked. I just got caught. You know, these kinds of things. So if you come up before the parole board and say that, you're not going to get out. You know, if you maintain your sense of innocence or your sense of being oppressed, your sense of being used or a victim of the system, you're not going to get out. And this is true in mental hospitals too. What you have to adopt is the staff's view of yourself and say, yes, I did it, I confess, I'm a bad guy, you know, or something like that. And then it shows that one has conformed to the system and now you can leave. If you ended up in a place like this, or a mental hospital, or a prison, the first thing you'd want to know is, how do you get out of here? What do you have to do to get out of here? And so that's most prisoners, that's what they're interested in. And one of the things is you have to show improvement. So if you never get in trouble, it's hard to show improvement. In other words, if you're on a consistently good acting person, then you haven't shown much improvement. So some prisoners, they'll start out like the first day or few days that they're there, they'll violate the rules in an open context, in a public context, and then something goes on their record, and then from that point on they keep a clean record, and so they can show improvement. It used to be like attending chapel services, but this isn't just not too many years ago, but it is a few, probably 10, 15 years ago. And I always wondered, how do chaplains feel when they know that most of the people sitting out there are there because they want to get out of prison, not because they're interested in attending the services? Well, since that time, chaplains have gotten smart about this, and so they don't keep any record of attendance, and they don't because they don't want this to be used as a method of getting out of prison. What has taken the place of that is AA, Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you've never touched a drop in your life, you go to AA anyway, because it helps with other, it's supposed to help with other personality or problems that you might have. And then you can show, you've been attending AA, or you've been taking occupational training. You've got something on your record. There's a really good book called by a guy named Robert Dahl, D-A-H-L, called Crack Up. And it's his when he went crazy and his cures and when he's in the mental institution, he looks at himself in the mirror all the time because he wants to develop a countenance that looks like, a normal, stable individual. And so when he's first in the mental hospital, he looks in the mirror and he says, wow, you've got to close your eyes a little bit. Everybody can see through you. Your eyes are just too wide open. You see this too in prisons in terms of adopting a countenance within the prison to protect oneself. You see prisoners standing in front of the mirror, and working on their looks, and stuff like this. I saw this really, it's kind of a sad context, but I was in a prison in Tracy, California, and it was just before lunch, and it was really funny because you could see in the cells, and just before the lunch, the release to go to the mess hall, you saw these prisoners, looking in the mirror and adopting their hard looks, so that when they walked down the hall, nobody would jump on them, or nobody would try to attack them or exploit them. These prison adjustments, I said, don't automatically occur or stem just from the prison experience itself. They stem from previous experiences that a person has had, and for the toughest convicts, it's those who have come up from where they were forced out of their families at an early age and into the system of foster homes and then maybe ranches for boys and then delinquency institutions and then work or trade schools, technical prisons, and then prisons for younger men and then mainline prisons, who have gone up that whole scale. And so from an early age, they've had this system that they've adopted, this adjustment system, reinforced over and over again. And these are the ones that are really difficult to deal with. Their experience in the past has taught them to lie, to cheat, to be deceitful, to be manipulative. You talk to, how hard it is when you're shifted from foster home to foster home, and there's a new set of rules each time. And the things that you were doing before, now you get in trouble for. The things that were rewarded in the past, now you might be punished for. And so it takes a system of finding out where the other person's coming from, what they want, and then falsely, deceitfully fitting into that. So it's reading other people, what their interests and values are, and then voicing, or somehow dramatically assenting to that, whereas inside the person, of course, has this deep kind of resentment. The psychiatrists point out that this adaptation, this manipulative and dishonesty, comes from a lack of love in one's childhood, or an inconsistency in terms of love, and in which produces an insecurity. And there is no inner security in these persons, or very little, and they have a keen sense of this insecurity. The idea that I don't have enough, that the world is unpredictable, the world is ungiving, you can't depend on anybody. And then they themselves are very questionably lovable or valuable. And they have the sense of themselves, I am not a lovable person, I am not a valuable person. So they scramble for love wherever they can find it. But they don't know how to handle it once they find it, because of this conception of themselves as being an unlovable person. So what they do, and this is what makes it so difficult to work with these people, is that their reaction to being loved is to create or leads to an unloving, manipulative kind of Machiavellian behavior, which brings about a rejection of them. And so their reaction to being loved produces a rejection of them, which reinforces this system. Why do they do this? They're so scared of losing friendship. And this fear, you know, that now I finally have a friend, I have somebody that's interested in me, I'm so scared of losing that person that I'll do anything to make that person think I'm okay. And the way they do it is by manipulating and deceitful activity, and because they don't want the person to see any kind of evil or bad side of them. And so they try to hide that and appear in a good light all the time. This is easy to see through. You see, mainly because of this lack of maturity, their manipulation is apparent to anybody who deals with them. You see them assenting to anything you say, or to, you know, but that changes from context to context. One of the one author has that I've read has put out a handbook for guards and people that are going to go to work in prison. And what he's trying to do is to show people how to break through some of this. And he calls it games criminals play, based on Eric Berne's notions that are called transactional analysis. He came out with a book many years ago called Games People Play. It's the I'm okay, you're okay kind of approach to life, or therapeutic mode. And he mentions that some of the methods that criminals will use to get straight people, or guards in this case, to identify with their needs so that eventually they can be used. Within prisons, the manipulative prisoner gets status from fellow prisoners by being able to manipulate it and use the system to get what one wants without giving one's assent or giving into the authority of the system. And what happens, the programs I've worked with where convicts come out of prison and come to college, is that they'll try to manipulate the system to get good grades without ever assenting to the rules and authority of the system. You know, so it's like not turning papers in on time, you know, asking for extensions, all of these kinds of things, eventually trying to get a passing grade, without having to do any work. And sometimes you think they've organized their whole life around doing this. It takes so much time and effort to do something like this, where if they just followed the rules, it would be so much easier. And you don't know why, you know, you think, why do they do this? You know, well, it's just the system that's been reinforced. One of the tools is to, of course, heap praises on the person. Gee, you're great, you know, you're wonderful, all those kinds of things. And then, you know, suck the person into one's system. This can happen. Like one time, this fellow that I was working with, he came to my door. And he says, I had mentioned my wife and I wanted to get some bicycles to ride around. So he came to the door with a couple bicycles. And he says, you know, unfortunately, they were chained together. And he says, you know, here's some bicycles, you know. And, well, I tell you, it was tough to learn how to ride that way. But, no, but, you know, it's this kind of thing, doing favors for you, you know. And but you know that once you give in to some of these favors, they've got a hook on you. And, you know, you yourself have descended to a level where you can be used then. And you have to watch out for things like that. Empathy, you know, or sympathy, you know, saying that they feel just like you do, that they've had the same experience you do, that you have had. Well, there's a lot of us that have had kinds of rejections in our life or one way or another, or hard times in our life where we've had to, you know, parents or loved ones that have had trouble. And so it's kind of easy to find points at which a person can identify with you, or you can identify with that person. There's also the plea for help. You know, we're confronted with this, like when you walk down the street and somebody says, hey, can you spare a quarter? And, you know, some got any spare change? You know, that kind of thing. And you don't really know how to handle it. You don't really know what to do in those kinds of circumstances. When a person reaches out for help, do they really need this help, or are they using you? You know, are they really telling you the truth? You know, what do you want the money for? Those kinds of things, you know. When I was a kid, this didn't happen for quite a long time, and I just noticed it starting to happen again. When I was a kid, my father is a minister, and occasionally there'd be a hobo, you know, that would come to the door and knock on the door and ask my father for something. And so I suppose what the guy had done was look up in the phone book and find out where the ministers in town lived or something like that, and then go around and knock on their door. And one guy, you know, like I remember one time he had to get to San Diego or something like that, but some emergency. And so he wanted my father to give him the bus fare to get to San Diego. And so my father didn't want to do that because he didn't know for sure whether the guy was going to use the money for that. And so he said, well, I'll meet you down at the bus station, you know, make sure the guy gets on the bus. And I don't know whether the guy really wanted to go to San Diego or not, but he ended up on the bus going to San Diego. You know, but I remember, you know, Sunday afternoons sitting at dinner, you know, Sunday, which was, you know, a big dinner, and you know, it used to be, I don't know if it still is, after church. And, you know, with bums sitting there watching him eat, because my father wanted to make sure he didn't give these people money that they were going to misuse one way or another. So, you know, what if you're faced with this, what you have to do is make sure the person uses the appropriate channels. And then that's a pretty good test to see whether they're really interested in help or not, whether they'll start moving in the direction of self-help. Another kind of hook that where one tends to end up getting manipulated is to get involved in the we-they syndrome. Byrne, in his book Games People Play, calls it the ain't it awful game. You know, where you sit down and you just talk about, you know, isn't nuclear war awful? You know, this happens like American foreign policy. You know, isn't it terrible? You know, and yes, it is. You know, and then you give all these examples, da da da, and you go back and forth. Ain't it awful? You know, what people do, brutality, da da da, and then that's a game because it doesn't lead anywhere. You know, what has happened afterwards? Nothing. You know, there's no change. You've just talked. It's been a way to talk. But if one identifies with this, then with this point of view, the we-they thing, and gets in that kind of game, then it's possible to pit, you know, staff or yourself against somebody else and to start being used. And like, this guard is really mistreating me. And then, so giving favors or granting favors, you know, might be something that comes out of that. Out of this system comes a particular point of view on the world, a set of beliefs or an ideology from these experiences and that these people have had in their life. These, I listed some of these. I wanted to, if I can find them. Attitudes such as these. Only suckers work. The world owes me a living. Everybody's a crook at heart. And never cop out to authorities. Only the hard survive. And then it also develops a series of excuses and justifications for one's past behavior. These have to do with, condemning the condemners. That those people who put me here are just as corrupt, you know, or more corrupt than I am. The system is so corrupt. Denial of injury. That the persons I hurt deserved it, you know, for one reason or another. These are things, of course, that we all learn. And little kids can voice these things very easily. You know, if you catch a child doing something wrong and you come up to them and say, you did something wrong, they got these things right at their fingertips at probably the age of 3. You know, it was his fault. Nobody got hurt. Everybody's doing it. You know, all those kinds of things. It's difficult to, in the status that comes from successfully manipulating the system, it's very difficult to break into. And under number 4 there, deviation amplifying feedback systems. Maybe you're acquainted with this concept. It comes from systems theory. And it's the idea that once a system is a working system is set up and some kind of change takes place that influences the system one way or another, that the system reacts in such a way to produce the problem to a greater degree. In other words, the interconnections in the system work in such a way that the reaction to the problem, the reaction to the deviation, simply reinforces the problem. And I see how this is probably, you've had this experience in your own behavior systems with somebody else, where you've discovered after a while that what you were doing to react to what you felt was a problem was in fact increasing the problem. You know, your learned response or kind of thing did not help. It made things worse. One example of a physical system might be something like a thermostat in a furnace, where you have the atmospheric temperature, which when it gets to a low point influences the thermostat, which in turn turns on a furnace, which lowers the atmospheric temperature, which turns off the thermostat, or which affects the thermostat, which turns off the furnace, and so on. And once, if everything's working fine, then the system goes along and everything's okay and there's some kind of consistent temperature kept. But what happens if all of a sudden it gets too cold and the furnace can't work fast enough to keep the temperature up to a certain level? Then the thermostat is not affected. The furnace keeps going, but the furnace works harder and harder and harder till the point where the furnace breaks, and then, you know, the whole system breaks down. The convict system, what's happening is, and this will summarize some of the things I've been saying, is that they begin by scrambling for attention. They need attention. They're dependent on others for love. So once a person shows some kind of concern or whatever for them, they eat it up right away. But they've got this problem in that they have this belief that no one can love them, that they're not lovable persons, that if people really knew the truth about them, they would not like them. And so to keep or maintain that love, they use manipulative techniques or deceit and dishonesty. And this affects the person who's been showing concern for this individual by saying, or the person says to themselves, well, I thought this person, you know, was salvageable or a nice person or could be my friend, but apparently he or she is con-wise just like everybody else here, and I can't trust that person, which leads to rejection, which reinforces the notion that they're unlovable, which just keeps the system going then. You see, and it's a fine working system, and it's reinforced over their entire lives. So the question is, how do you break into that system to demolish it, to break it down, so that it will not be self-perpetuating? Where can one break into that system? Now, at the level of being unlovable, there's a surface sense of acceptance that most of us have learned in this culture. That when you first meet somebody, you play sort of like you like them. You know, that doesn't occur in all cultures, but in our culture, it's sort of a norm or a rule. You know, when you're introduced to somebody, you smile and shake their hands and say yes. It's a sort of a surface acceptance. So we have that going for us, at least. You know, in that you don't you may never want to see that person again in your life, but at least there's an opening that can be worked with. There's a sense of that this can be reinforced then through concern. And how do we show concern? By listening, by attending to the person. In other words, you can play like this person is a great speaker, you know, or something like that. And you're listening to what they say, and last week when Tom Watkins was here, some of you weren't here, but he gave a whole bunch of sessions on how to listen. And this is exactly what this means. Convicts have this terminology they use. They call shining them on. You know, that where you listen to a person, but you're not really listening to them. The reason you're listening to them is because you want them to stop talking. And so you just play. You know, you just let the person play out their line, sort of, and then you can go away. And you've never heard anything they've said. And you've just agreed. Yes. Oh yeah. Yes. Yes. And then they finally said everything. Then you go away. But this, in other words, active listening is not that. It's actually putting oneself out. It's making the effort, and that's difficult to do in many cases. Maybe for a lot of us, it's difficult to do even with our children. You know, children tend to start out talking incessantly, and you can't listen to everything they say because most of it you don't want to listen to. So how do you teach them just to say important things or interesting things? Well, you have to make them think that they're worthwhile persons, because only worthwhile persons say worthwhile things. And so you have to start out by active listening and responding and so on. And so they learn to accept themselves that they're saying something that might be worthwhile over time. Probably the hardest part to deal with in the system is the manipulating behavior. It's difficult. Their acceptance is so, like I said, is so novel to them. They've never, maybe somebody from the straight world has never really been nice to them before, and they don't know how to handle it. And they're so scared they're going to do something to make that person mad at them or reject them, that they'll do anything to look good. They'll read any book you say. You know, they'll talk about anything you want to talk about. What one has to do, I think, in this, to break through this manipulation, is to help the person see the kind of system that they're caught up in, and to try to help them, once one gains their confidence, to see how their behavior is a reaction to their experience, and how this deviation amplifying feedback system works to their detriment, and how they're being used, how they're simply going along with what's expected of them, and how they're never going to grow or get control of their lives in this, or as long as they play that system or play that game. And this is really difficult to do. It takes a lot of work. And this is really where the therapy kind of comes in. And you have to find a language that the person can understand. It may be a kind of a therapeutic mode of one sort or another, like transactional analysis, to help them see how they play the role of the bad guy, and why it is that they get rejected, and why they end up failing so often. This is really hard work, and it takes confrontation sometimes, and it takes effort, and it's draining on the individual who's doing it. It takes energy. Each of us has what's called, what Irving Goffman calls a moral career. You're acquainted with the notion of a career. Each of us has a career in terms of occupation or vocation. We may not get paid for what we do, but we have some kind of a vocation. And as you think about the vocation that you have, where did it start? How did you develop it, the notion that you were going to do that type of thing? Where did it come from? What were the influences on your life? In other words, one doesn't wake up one day and become a minister, or a nurse, or something like this. That we can look back in our lives in a retrospective way, and we can reconstruct how we ended up where we are in terms of our vocation. This is also true and analogous to the fact that each of us has a moral career. In other words, we have, through our life, had a series of definitions about ourselves and other people that have been changed, reinforced, changed again, or what, over time. And we can reconstruct where we have come to in terms of our ideas, our evaluations, and judgments about ourselves. What do I think about myself and others like me? Or what do I think about others that aren't like me? Or what do I think about myself if I were something else? In other words, a series of judgments, good or bad. Some of us, if it affects us this way. We end up saying, how is it that I turned out to be one of those persons my mother always warned me about? Or people that you grew up thinking that these were evil or bad persons, and now you're not so sure about that. In other words, your evaluation of other people. Or maybe those people that you thought were good, upstanding people in one respect or another, now you consider to be not so good and not so upstanding. What were the influences on you that made those changes? And some people make drastic changes in this regard, where they change their entire orientation toward life. This moral career for the convict or the person who's in a mental hospital is, of course, much more serious, because what we're asking them to do is to reorient their understanding of who their friends are and who their foes are, to redefine their moral existence. And this is always done in a retrospective way. In other words, the phrase that I use is that, to key into this, is that the present, or the past changes, the past changes as fast as our present is changing. In other words, the way that we evaluate things that have gone on in our life, in our upbringing, our relationship to our parents, to our friends, our experience in school, all of those types of things change as much as our present life is changing. In other words, if you go through a drastic change right now, and especially one that you didn't expect, a life change of one sort or another, like you end up in prison. And there are examples of this. I suppose one of the primary examples in the New Testament is Paul, the Apostle Paul. And he had to make a complete reevaluation of his past in terms of a particular incident that happened to him. In recent times, maybe think of Richard Nixon, I think he avoided reevaluating his past in some way. But somebody who did was Charles Colson, who was part of that Watergate thing, where he had power, influence, a success story. His success story all of a sudden turned into a failure story. So what was his? So he had to reevaluate his past to have the failure as a conclusion. See, the present is the conclusion of the story. And then as the present changes, the conclusion changes, so that the rest of the story has to change to make sense in terms of the conclusion. And so what we're trying to do with convicts in reconverting them, or converting them, is to try to get them to retrospectively change their past and their interpretation of their past and the experiences and the evaluation of the experiences in their lives. Now, this is something that's difficult to do. I know you're acquainted with this these sets of verses in the Bible, but I just wanted to read them over because I wanted to point out that something about energy for doing this type of thing. This is from Matthew 25. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate them one from another, as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep at his right hand, but the goats at the left. This is this notion of judgment, anti-universalism, that many are called, few are chosen. You know, these kinds of sets of verses. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, come, O blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see thee hungry and feed thee, or thirsty and give thee drink? And when did we see thee a stranger and welcome thee, or naked and clothe thee? And when did we see thee sick or in prison and visit thee? And the king will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did it to one of these least of these my brethren, you did it to me. Then he will say to those at his left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they will also say, Lord, when did we see thee hungry, or thirsty, or a stranger, or naked, or sick, or in prison, and did not minister to thee? Then he will answer them, truly I say to you, as you did it not to one of the least of these, you did it not to me. And they will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. And I think what we have to realize is that it's impossible to do these things right now. That it takes a long process of spiritual growth in ourselves to be able to effectively open ourselves up to others so that they too can spiritually grow and reap the benefits of our openness and lovingness toward them. What it takes, in other words, a lot of us don't have enough love to left over or energy for love beyond our own families. In other words, you see people that have so little love they can't even give any toward their kids. They can't give any toward the ones they live with. They are making the first step. In other words, they have a long, long journey to go. Some people are blessed or have enough grace so that they can go, they have enough left over so they can have the energy and to make the effort to open themselves up to others. I've noticed in dealing with prisoners that it's important that one has a strong sense of self-respect and self-love. One has to know first, discover oneself and know who one is, and to develop a sense of discipline in one's life and self-respect and self-love so that one knows where one is at and what one can do. A lot of people go into prison work because they themselves need love. And it's easy to find people that will give you this kind of attention. Prisons are filled with them. You know, they'll tell you all, you know, you can be dependent upon them. But that's not what they need. They don't need you to assent to whatever they say or their particular lifestyle, or to suck you in and use you. To identify with the oppressed, such as in these verses that I just read, and the poor and the powerless, the answer for these people is a kind of love that will enable them to take control of their own existence. To take control of their own lives. In other words, one just doesn't go to work for the oppressed against the system, because these people will not grow only from that. In other words, they will not benefit eventually from that unless they themselves have grown enough and have developed the ability to take control of their own existence and to know what their goals are and what they want to achieve. Otherwise, they lead a life of deceit or self-delusion where they've been in the past and they haven't come out of that. I mentioned this the other day, that when you know when a person has come to terms with themselves, they don't blame others for their existence any longer and use that as an excuse for staying where they're at. They come to see that they can't depend on others to liberate them. They can't depend on others to show them the way or to take care of their existence. They have to do it themselves. Otherwise, they're not liberated. Frantz Fanon, in his book The Wretched of the Earth, talks about this over and over again in dealing with psychotherapy toward oppressed peoples and colonialized peoples, that this life within colonialism means that they have this secondary citizen understanding of themselves. And the liberation doesn't necessarily affect that. What they have to do is come to see that they are powerful enough to work changes in their own lives. And so you know when a person's done this, when they themselves have developed the capacity to go out and help others, when they've developed the capacity to be therapists for other people, when they have a strong enough sense of themselves that they can start opening up and giving to other people. Now, a couple programs that I've been acquainted with, where inmates will, through counseling, through discussion among themselves, get to a point where they can go out of the prison and talk to juveniles, go to delinquency institutions, go to colleges and so on, and explain what it is that got them into the kind of conditions that they were in, and to stop blaming other people, and which is a dishonest response, and to say, look, I'm in control of this. I cannot be forgiven. I have to work through it myself. I don't know if you remember the myth of Orestes in Greek mythology, but Orestes was this person who was mentally ill. He was plagued by the Furies because of something his father had done and what his family had done. And so finally, he can't stand it any longer. So one day he says, he appeals to the gods. He says, look, this wasn't my fault. How come you're plaguing me this way? And so the gods up on Olympus, they divide up into two groups and they have this trial and whether they should forgive Orestes or not. And Apollo says, you know, well, really it was my fault because some of the things I did got this group in trouble to begin with. And so it looks like Orestes is going to be forgiven. And Orestes stands up in his own defense and says, don't forgive me. He says, it's my problem and I got to work through it. And the gods are so astounded. You know, they've never heard anything like this before. And what happens, of course, is the Furies turn into the Eumenides and actually are sources of spiritual growth and advice for Orestes over time. So it's the person turns their past experience into strength rather than to something that holds them down. And that's what we're working for. And it's... for us working with people like this, it's not self-sacrifice, although a lot of people would experience it that way. If it is experienced as self-sacrifice, then it's not enlarging one's own self. But we always get this promise in the New Testament that we, to the extent that we give ourselves to others, we ourselves should be growing too. In other words, it's a two-way street. In this sense, love is kind of selfish, in that we love others in order to have our own capacity for love enhanced. And that's the aim or the purpose, is the self-growth. And so if one is not achieving self-growth, this has happened to me occasionally, I'm sure it's happened to you too, where you say, I can't put myself out anymore. It's just robbing my life from other areas. It's called burnout, you know, some people in modern usage. And it's important to see that love in this kind of love is not a feeling, because you have to love these repugnant people, you know, these people that you probably thought you'd never have to go near in your life before. And it's to be able to do that means that you know, that one has really made a lot of steps along the path. And so it always takes work, and it takes courage, it takes risk, it takes confrontation, and the knowledge of when to confront somebody. It takes the ability to handle loss, to handle failure. When I've taken a class, I take classes to San Francisco and visit institutions or agencies or people that deal with problem persons. And there's a Lutheran minister named Chuck Lewis who works with people who live in one of the slum areas of San Francisco. And the most interesting thing he does for the students is give them his what he calls his theology of his work, which I call it the philosophy of his work, but he calls it the theology of his work, and how he can continue doing what he's doing over the years and face so much failure, you know, in what he's done and triumph in what he's done. And he says it isn't, you know, what he has to constantly remind himself is that it's God working through him. It's not, he doesn't take the responsibility for success. He doesn't take the responsibility for failure. He does what he can. And if he did take that responsibility, maybe he couldn't do it too much any longer. But there is this sense of responsibility that I think is that has to be there too, you know, for our own spiritual growth. So, well, let's stop here. Are there any questions or comments? I could go on and on. Oh, well, see, I teach in a college, and we have a program where convicts that are going to be paroled, that have their high school degrees, that, you know, think they can go to college, can try to get a program where they move from the prison to the college, which is, you know, I don't know if you ever thought about this, but college is really an ideal atmosphere. It's like a halfway house, because there's a lot of tolerance in college for people screwing up, you know. I don't know, you went to college yourself. There's a lot of different lifestyles, and because a lot of students are at that level of life themselves where they don't have a lot of commitment to a straight kind of ordinary existence, but they themselves are searching and idealistic and all of that. And a lot of students will open themselves up to convicts, you know, just because they kind of identify with themselves being in some of a similar situation. So this, yes. I wanted to mention, too, I mentioned that one program. This is, I think, Charles Colson's program, Prison Fellowship, has been very successful. And this is really the goal of his whole program, is to enlighten convicts to see the existence in which they're living, to change themselves. And he uses convicts for this purpose. Yeah. I think that's, you know, it's been very... You know, they're even getting financially well off, which is tough when you're only dealing with convicts. but when Dan Erlander was talking the other night about China and Christianity in China, I thought, you know, the Chinese and the Orientals tend to get into fads, you know, easily, you know, one way or the other. And you wonder how much Christianity might become a fad in China. And Prison Fellowship has become successful enough that I kind of wonder about the same thing, you know, Christianity being adopted as sort of just a style of speaking, you know, and it isn't so embarrassing to talk about Jesus or God in prison as much as it used to be.